Mammoth
Audio. This is Scamapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not leave a review on iTunes? Don't keep them to yourselves. Shout them from the rooftop like a declaration of love. Or just give me a couple of stars. I don't care. Whatever you want. Documentary films are not supposed to lie to us. They're supposed to cast a cold, unflinching light on the truth and illuminate us and the world we live in. So why then does F is for Fake do the exact opposite? The final major film of Orson Welles is a Gordian knot of lies, deception, and stories so unbelievable they must be true. Featuring the tales of three very different deceivers, an art forger, a literary hoaxer, and Welles himself, a man known for his love of both hoaxes and magic, F is for Fake is a grab bag of special effects, magic tricks, and stories that stay with you long after the film has finished. On today's episode, Simon Caterson and I delve deep into the world of F is for Fake and try and figure out what is the truth and what is just a damn good story created in the air. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scamapalooza. Now, I mispronounced your name last time, and I've always called you Simon Caterson, but it's Simon Caterson.
Indeed.
And you've never corrected me.
Oh, that's all right.
Because you're a gentleman and a scholar.
No, you know, I'm used to it.
Okay, I'm joined today by Simon Caterson. Last time you were on the show, you talked about Nightmare Alley, film noir classic, and we are also talking this week about another film classic, but a completely different type of movie in almost every way from Nightmare Alley, and that is Orson Welles' 1972 classic F is for Fake. When did you first see this one? Is this one that you've seen over and over again over the years?
I have. And every time I see it, it's a different film. It's it kind of becomes more and more unknowable, I think, ultimately, as the years go by. The only thing you can really be sure of with that film is that by the end of it, you've seen a film.
It is a mess, really. Like, you are being charitable. It is, I mean, it is a, the film is an absolute mess, and a glorious mess at that. It is just a constant collage of images and suddenly jumping to magic tricks from fact to fiction to interviews to vox pop to anything you could possibly put into a film. He seems to have jammed it onto the screen. It was Orson Welles' last major motion picture that he directed himself. He went on to do a few other things, including his final role as the planet devouring Transformer in the Transformers movie. That was his last role, which is depressing. So it's perhaps better to think of this as his last motion picture. But it definitely feels like someone who, it doesn't feel like he's given up, but it's certainly someone who just doesn't care anymore about what people think and about the establishment of Hollywood and what a film is and isn't supposed to do. And it's really just, this is the subjects that I'm interested in, and this is the way in which I am going to show it to you. And if you like that, that's fantastic. But if not, get stuffed.
Yeah, it's a film which I guess anyone interested in film editing would have to see, because a lot of those apparently random stories and scenes and events that you describe are the occasion of some marvelous editing, pre-digital editing. But again, you know, he kind of doesn't care about what material he's using, who it's from. There's material, it's not clear. One of the themes that he pursues somewhat is authorship and so on. And of course, the film is not the film he started out making. It contains elements from other filmmakers. He cuts up dialogue even between characters from pieces of film that have nothing to do with each other. The tempo of the film is quite erratic. There are some quiet, lovely moments, like at Chartres Cathedral, and he quotes poetry, and when it suits him, he does these tricks you mentioned when it suits him. At other times, somebody else takes over and tells a long story about Picasso. And then, of course, the film starts with bizarre sort of butt-watching sequence where his then lover at that time is wandering around some streets being ogled by guys in cars, but it's found it's archival footage that's been cut to so what's that, you know? And and then of course he does his famous are we allowed to say his famous after 1 hour thing?
Maybe we'll save that for a little bit. Let's say up front, if you haven't seen If It's For Fake, I mean, we can explain the plot in 30 seconds, or the plot or the story of what he covers. And essentially he sets out to make a documentary about famed art forger Amir de Horace, is how I pronounce it. Great. Yeah. Who's this very flamboyant man who's famed for being able to recreate the works of all of the masters. And one of the people that he interviews is Clifford Irving, who is a writer who's written a book called Fake about Amir. And after the documentary was filmed, but before it was finished, it was revealed that Clifford Irving himself was responsible for perhaps the greatest hoax of the 20th century, which was the Howard Hughes memoirs. He claimed to have the memoirs of the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes, and in reality, he'd written them himself. And so I think Orson Welles describes it as he's the author of a book about a faker who is himself a fake, the author of the fake to end all fakes.
And again, you learn it in that sort of fractured way that Welles presents the material, so that again he didn't know that Clifford Irving was doing this at the time. Clifford Irving was part of the same circle of people who were living in Ibiza, and of course Irving's wife was wife at the time was in on it also, and she was later of course indicted along with him.
Yeah.
I think Welles has to. Well, does the universe revolve around Welles, or is Welles merely, you know, everywhere, omnipresent? Because I don't think he is the center of the film, so he talks about also his own hoax history, in particular the Martian War of the Worlds Martian invasion broadcast, which is probably not as was never as spectacular and as he made out, or that subsequent legend myth making has led us to believe. But
yeah, and it's interesting that, like a lot of things, he touches briefly on the hoax, on the War of the Worlds hoax, without going into a lot of detail, and instead allowing us to remember and misremember what we know. You know, because the mythical version is that he made a radio documentary, a radio play that was so believable that when people switched it on, that they believed that there really was an invasion from Mars, and they took to the streets and rioted, and people tried to kill themselves, and people shot their double barrel shotguns at water towers, all because of this extraordinary work of art that was his War of the Worlds radio play. And I think it deserves I think I'll probably do an entire episode just on the War of the Worlds hoax, so we don't give away too much, but it wasn't quite what happened. And it's brilliant that he just lets these lies and these mysteries just kind of, he lets them out, and he doesn't necessarily tell them to you, but he just lets them fester and grow throughout the movie.
Yes. Yeah, no, he kind of puts it out there, and like you say, and he's the center of the whole thing, but at the same time, he drifts in and out. Mm-hmm. You know, he kind of disappears at times, he reappears at other times, and of course he does the whole magician thing with the big cloak and so on. So he becomes a kind of a mysterious, enigmatic figure of his own invention as well. And there's lots of stuff which is just, like you say, is just mad stuff in a film, any kind of film, much less a film of the 70s, which, you know, was a decade of some strange films. But he, you know, even these long shots of Howard Hughes' penthouse at the top of the hotel in Las Vegas, you know, long, long shots of the same thing. You know, they're quite, There's nothing else like it.
Yeah. And what's great is that he lets us know this from the start, because the movie opens with him on a rail, at a rail station performing magic for a small boy, and what appears to be the boy's mother, but clearly is not the boy's mother, is watching through the open window of a train as he turns coins into keys and back again, and then produces coins from the boy's nose. And then a rabbit just seems to be there. It doesn't really appear. It just sort of is there briefly. And it's cutting then to what is clearly different shots shot at a different time of members of the general public kind of peering over in their general direction. And then one of those shots is of the camera people, the people making the film. And that's how he introduces his co-filmmaker in, you know, to remind us from the beginning that this is all fake. This is all lies. This is a movie. And you constantly seeing the cameraman and just appear and disappear throughout the film. What did you think of the magic? Did you like the magic tricks? Do you think they were good tricks as a layperson?
I don't think they're the most memorable part of the film. I like a lot of people, I guess, enjoy the scene in, you know, Chartres Cathedral, which is a quite, you know, stands out as being, you know, sort of at odds with the mood of the rest of the film. Mm. And it's gloriously over the top, like everything else he did. I mean, even his insecurities are mammoth. You know, even his sort of anxiety about himself is ginormous. He was larger than life, and even by movie star standards, that comes through massively in the film. It's he would like us all to believe that he contains multitudes under that capacious cape of his, and he very nearly succeeds. Increasingly, I feel that I'm not sure that you can derive very much from it, except that it's a big, massive Orson Welles, you know, film.
Yeah, it does remind me of the kind of the mystery story or magic trick in which someone makes a large declarative statement and then pauses dramatically and says, "Or is it?" And that the whole way through the film, and just when we're, you know, the scene in the cathedral, just when we're getting feeling like we're being brought into this traditional documentary world, he suddenly snaps back out and says, "And here's a rabbit, or here's some dancing girls, or here's a scene in a, you know, in a nightclub," for some reason that doesn't feel like it belongs, and constantly reminds you that you're watching a movie, which is the exact opposite of what a filmmaker is supposed to do, which is to make you forget about the edits and forget about the artifice of it all.
So, yeah, and of course, different kinds of magic going on. There's ordinary magic, you know, with, you know, like you say, with coins and things like that. Ordinary.
Can I say, as a magician, I find the fact you called it ordinary magic quite offensive. But go on.
I used the wrong word, but I was going to go on and contrast it with what I was going to call movie magic, you know, special effects like levitation and things like that. So there's the things that, you know, well, of course, no one but a highly qualified special person who's a magician could do, but nevertheless, any magician could do them.
Yeah.
Whereas there are other things that you do need a film crew for. And
That's why I asked you what you thought of the magic before, because as a magician watching it, he has his coin and key, and from a layperson's perspective, both someone who doesn't know a lot about movie editing or magic would watch that and go, "I'm watching sleight of hand." But as someone who knows a little bit about film editing and quite a lot about magic, I can see that he's not actually doing that much magic. Like, he will put a coin in his hand, and then it will cut to a quick reaction shot from the boy and then back to his hand again. And then the coin's gone. And there's a few moments where he puts the coin cleanly in his hand, closes his hand, open it, it's a key. And that's clearly a magic trick. But there's so much actual film editing going on that a lot of what you think is, as you put it, ordinary magic, is in fact movie magic. And you mentioned the levitation when he floats up in the air. So you see that as movie magic, when he floats up in the air and then disappears in midair?
Well, that's how I would take it, but I understand that, that you can have live action levitation.
Because what that in fact is a he just performed a magic trick, and what you saw is what would have happened if you saw it live. So it's that's what he does, though. He makes us think that we're watching one thing when we're watching another all throughout the movie. And do you think? I mean, it feels like the movie got away from him. That he started off making a more traditional documentary about Amir Dahoura and got lost along the way.
Yeah, I think the way he solved the problem of not being able to really finish things, which notoriously he fell prey to, you know, through the greater part of his career, was to leave it, you know, just open-ended like that. But also, it's a sort of object lesson in editing. And I wonder if he got caught up in that aspect, you know, the real filmmaker in him, having had all this fun, you know, in front of the camera, actually enjoyed that process, and like you say, really didn't care or chose not to be mindful of how the finished product would appear or whether anyone would understand what the hell was going on is kind of a fitting epitaph for him. And but I'm very. It's a film that does repay constant viewings, but don't expect to be enlightened.
Yeah, no. At no point you feel frustrated. Documentaries aren't supposed to do that. Documentaries are supposed to come away having learnt something and feel like you're enriched in some way intellectually. Whereas this, you come away feeling like you're doubting the subject matter in particular. In fact, because I've read Fake and I've read Clifford Irving's Project Octavia. I think I can't remember this. He's got there's so many of them books about. You know, that hoax, the Howard Hughes hoax.
Have you read the autobiography itself?
I haven't. No, I have it somewhere on my shelf. Oh, but yes. I have a couple of books like that, which are they are the subject of the hoax. So rather than being they are the hoax. And I always struggle with them because as I'm reading it, I'm going, well, this isn't true. This isn't, you know, and I'm reading lies. I'm reading stuff that isn't true. I'm reading a work of fiction and I'm not sure why I would. Like I either want to read the truth or I want to read fiction, and this muddle frustrates me a bit. Like that, I went and saw the Revenant. I can't remember
the Revenant.
I kept calling it. I think everyone's been doing that. The Leonardo DiCaprio film, and that is inspired by actual events. I think what they've said, and the bare bones of the story is true, but a huge portion of it isn't true. And they don't claim that it is. And
people have been raped by bears, though.
Yeah, it really does look like. I mean, look, let's not get too sidetracked into the. It really does look like the bear is sexually assaulting him in the film. It's not meant to be, and it's a female bear, and no, you're absolutely right. That's what it looks like in the movie. But so much of it is clearly is not what happened, and he doesn't, you know. And for me, I think I want something that is either truth or fiction, and that mix in between always frustrates me.
Yeah,
is perhaps why this film I love so much is because it frustrates me in just the right way.
Yeah, it's not based on a true story. It's the truth it carries is entirely contrived, confected. Truth, it carries its own considerable weight.
Yeah,
I think that's probably why you can be frustrated by it, but still find it compelling.
Yeah. Let's talk about Dahoura himself, who was supposed to be the subject of the film and is for a while what. The person who is the center of the movie for a brief period anyway. So he started out as a struggling artist. And this is his version of events, of course. He started out as a struggling artist. The artistic world turned against him and refused to recognize his genius. And so in order to, out of both desperation and in order to show up the experts who failed to see what a brilliant artist he was, he started to fake the works of masters, and all around the world in great galleries and museums there are his faked paintings hanging among the real thing, and no one will ever know which is which.
No, because he, well, partly because he did them at the same time. And of course he, in the film, there's some discussion of critics, you know, and how, you know, there's something noble or something aesthetic in what he did, was to, in a way, to show up the critics. He and Wells are united in their hatred of critics, yeah, obviously. But yeah, it was a way of making money when he couldn't have made money otherwise, apparently. Mm. You know, it's a common, it's the excuse that every criminal uses, you know, it was society that made me do it. It you know, it wasn't my, you know, I needed to survive, and I guess he found those higher motives later on. I mean, one of the interesting things is that where he's living in Ibiza, it's in a house that he doesn't own. It's owned by an art dealer, and that's the other sort of sinister aspect to this, is the complicity of other people, art dealers in particular, in passing off fakes in order of, and as the classic middlemen, that they're the ones that make the real money, not the struggling artist. And of course, you know, in his own way, Clifford Irving stood to make and did attract an enormous advance for this publishing event of the century, which was the autobiography of this notoriously eccentric and reclusive billionaire,
yeah,
who'd led a very interesting life. You know, he'd been a movie studio owner, he'd been an aircraft pioneer, he'd done all sorts of amazing things, it was, you know, also deeply strange, mentally very ill, and so how else was Irving going to break through ultimately, but by confecting, you know, giving the public what they thought they wanted, giving publishers what they were willing to pay vast amounts for, this is the sort of hoax justification often, is that I'm you know, merely supplying a demand. I'm doing so by hoodwinking you, but it's what you really want to have, and I'm just the agent of that. So it must be a temptation.
Irving sets himself up as just a humble storyteller, and he talks about his failed early works of fiction, which is quite telling when he mentions the fact that he tried writing fiction, wasn't successful, and so went to nonfiction, and combined them both in Howard Hughes. But he talks a lot about, as autobiographer, that he feels like that he is the person who is in possession of the truth, and that even the subject himself isn't aware of the truth and isn't willing to recognize who he truly is, and that if he was ever presented with, you know, if he ever did actually, you know, perhaps read the book Fake that Clifford Irving had written, that he would not be able to handle the truth about himself as published in the story.
Well, ultimately, of course, Emir did commit suicide in mysterious circumstances. I mean, everything about him appears to me mysterious. Like you say, he was the only witness to a lot of events and circumstances of his life, and is unreliable. Irving cannot be trusted or can he? It's all very murky. Mm. And it's a slippery slope too, because you couldn't really, it's very rare for a hoaxer, in fact I'm trying to think of an example, who comes back from that notoriety, whose reputation is somehow restored.
It only ever seems to be those who can pass it off as a grand practical joke, as a lark, or as some sort of artist statement. But for those who do it for money, or who do it for some kind of broader acclaim, they very rarely manage to return.
Actually, one example, funnily enough, we're all mindful of the passing of David Bowie, was the Nat Tate hoax that he participated in with William Boyd. Where have you seen that one? It's an artist's monograph, creating this imaginary artist, contemporary artist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Bowie lent credibility to this by writing a foreword and financing it, I think. But so that was just a bit of fun, you know. Nobody was, least of all Bowie, but not Boyd either, was ever going to suffer from that. That was just a practical joke.
Yeah, and it tends to be, I find, the people who are the victims of the hoax are the ones who really struggle to recover, those who believe it and put stake their reputation behind what turns out to be, you know, a pack of lies. They're often the ones who never quite make it back.
Oh, indeed, and that's why these characters are criminals, and both of them, both Irving and Amir, did jail time along the way, and neither of them, you know, they lost their reputations.
Yeah.
So Wells, of course, whose Martian invasion radio show was simply, you know, it was an adaptation of the H.G. Wells novel. It wasn't it was presented in a realistic way. As a kind of live news broadcast, it was meant to be plausible, but not authentic.
Well, the reason given as to why people believed that the radio play was real was because at the beginning it said, you know, welcome to, I think it was the Mercury Science Fiction Theatre, and tonight's show we've got War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells classic, as you know, presented by the dynamite young director Orson Welles, brought to you by Camel cigarettes, in glorious, you know, mono sound, and that they had the big introduction, and then they would have it, and then there's Orson Welles has a speaking, you know, has a little narration, and then about 10 minutes in, it begins a fake concert. And then the concert is interrupted and keeps coming back. And that goes on for about 10 minutes of just this interruption as they bring in the police, come and make a statement about what's happening. And it's this slow unfurling, as it is in the book, this slow unfurling as, you know, farmers say what they saw, and then it looks like some scientists are there, and something's happened, there's smoke, there's fire, the humanity starts to come in. But because everyone... no one was listening to the broadcast. They were listening to Charlie McCarthy on the other station. So they all flicked over at the end of Charlie McCarthy and came in halfway through the news broadcast. And so that's why they believed it. And I can't imagine, for all of Wells's abilities as a director and as a master of publicity, I can't see him knowing that people would be switching over it. They would not have been doing that level of market research to know that no one's going to listen to the first 7.5 minutes. And so you should wait until then. So I feel like it was what hysteria there was must have been just a coincidence.
Mm.
I don't know.
And also something that, you know, that perhaps Wells enjoyed the fact that it, you know, there was this this legend. It did make an impact, which none of the many other literary adaptation broadcasts that the Mercury Theatre produced, you know, had that effect.
No.
And they're not remembered now, even though a lot of them are very good, actually.
Yeah, I listened to the Les Mis one, which I shouldn't call it Les Mis because then people expect the songs. That was pretty good.
The Heart of Darkness is very good too.
Yeah.
And he had a way of, like, he would take the material and rework it completely.
Mm, yeah.
And that's why, even if people had read The War of the Worlds, the novel, they wouldn't have twigged that this was an adaptation of it. But, you know, people are impressionable. I mean, people, you know, it is... There are a lot of people who will believe all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
What was that survey done about where people were asked if they'd like to bomb that location which only exists in the film Aladdin? and you know, a surprising number of people said, yes, no, let's do it. presumably because they thought IS was there or something like that. But when prompted, they will, you know, agree if that fits the mood of the temper of the times. And of course, you know, this was before the Cold War, but it was the interwar period, you know, the rise of Nazi Germany, tensions, you know, it's not hard to imagine that the atmospherics were conducive to some sort of mass panic of this kind.
Yeah. I guess, though, the difference, you have like a huge difference between then that time, which is before, you know, the radio play, which is before he'd made Citizen Kane, which is another example of a true story being, you know, manipulated through the lens of fiction, and F is for Fake, which is a good 50 years later and is presented as, you know, you have an extraordinarily savvy viewership who are starting to understand the way in which movies are made and the way in which, you know, that perhaps what you're presented in the media is not entirely true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pre-Watergate, but well, it's definitely of the era.
Had indeed started by then.
Irony. Irony was invented in 1964 by Sir Reginald Ironis. no, you're right, yeah. I mean, that's it. People started to be more, you know, willing to second-guess what they were looking at. And by the time this film comes out, we're told, don't trust, you know, or do trust me, don't trust me. Filmmaking is a lie, but I'm going to tell you the truth. You shouldn't have trusted me because I lied to you the whole time. And that is, of course, the big twist, which I think we can get to. If you haven't seen the film, switch off now, you know, have a watch of the movie. We haven't spoiled anything yet, just before we go to the big twist, which is he says at the beginning of the movie, I'm going to tell you the truth for the next hour, and you can trust everything I say will be gospel truth. And it's true. He does everything he says is true, even though people are being, they're trying to mislead about their own personal stories. He is a reasonably objective observer. And then exactly 60 minutes in, he starts to tell a story, which is, you know, about Picasso. And I totally believed it. I was on hook, line, and sinker. Did you when you first saw it? Did you believe that?
Yeah, you after an hour of this stuff, you forget. Well, you forget time passing. There's no doubt, and so he does get you, and that's the film's. And so, no matter what else you take from the film, you are hoodwinked.
I mean,
it would be a very disengaged viewer who would not, you know, lose track of time in the film and just be kind of or, you know, sort of gobsmacked by just how outrageous and random the whole thing is.
Yeah. So the story is that Oya Koda, who is, as you said, is his lover and is featured throughout as the girl, that's her title, she starts telling a story about how when she was, you know, a little younger that she posed for the great Picasso, and Koda's grandfather, who was allegedly an art forger and had forged Picasso paintings himself, and so it's all being tied back together. And this story is very, I mean, even though story, it's quite ordinary, you know, it is just a story about, oh, here's another art forger, but this one happens to be related to my girlfriend. And so we just believe it. And then, of course, after 20-odd minutes of this, he says, I've been lying to you for the last 20 minutes and none of that happened. None of it was true. And I told you that I was going to tell you the truth for an hour and I did. And we fall for it completely. Why do you think that is?
I think because it's plausible. We've been sort of softened up. And also the story is kind of, in a way, tedious enough to be true.
Oh, like, it is tedious. Yeah. I think maybe the reason I drifted off. I lost interest a little bit by that point. Yeah, because it's the least interesting part of the film is the story of Picasso and the grandfather and the faked paintings, and yeah, it's not very yeah. And they do a little dramatic recreation at the end,
indeed,
which, you know, is of course itself a work of fiction.
Yeah. So again, well, it's about again, it's all about Wells. And of course, who Wells is with at the time, and there's this kind of I don't know, some sort of squaring up with Picasso, who was obviously a, you know, an alpha male, you know, possibly one of the few people in the world with an ego bigger or as big as Wells is himself. So this being such a personal film, one you naturally think that there's something going on like that possibly in Wells's imagination.
It's interesting because the story is quite believable, even though there's this massive coincidence that it just so happens that that her grandfather forged some paintings of an artist who Amir Horiz himself was forging at the same time, and that it's all interlinked, and yet the film itself is just jam-packed full of completely unbelievable coincidences, which are perhaps the only true parts of the story. The fact that it just happened that Orson Welles was interviewing a man who was about to be exposed for perpetrating the greatest hoax of the 20th century, and it just purely by chance. And so you just have these amazing sound bites where de Horace is giving them the advice on how to, you know, on how to deal with checks and cash if you're over in Switzerland. And then shortly after that, Clifford Irving and his wife are, you know, exposed, and his wife is in Switzerland trying to put money into Swiss bank accounts. And it's like, how, this is just that classic thing that happens to documentary filmmakers where, you know, if the cameras just happened to be rolling at this moment, then that's what makes the story.
Yeah. I mean, that happens. It's just popped into my head that, have you seen the Armstrong Lie, the documentary?
Oh, yeah.
Lance Armstrong?
Yeah.
That's a kind of example. I just thought of a similar thing where the filmmaker thought he was making one kind of film, but in fact it led to another very different kind of film. He thought he was, kind of in a way vindicating or being part of the truth in relation to that Armstrong was purporting, you know, to. And then, in reality, he was just an instrument of Armstrong's nefarious design.
Yeah.
Although he realized that to be the case because the story broke. But the filmmaker himself didn't know. It was only afterwards. And he just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And those sort of coincidences. But you associate those sort of coincidences with celebrities anyway. I mean, all celebrities seem to know, the really big ones seem to know all the others.
Yeah.
You know, there's this grand fellowship of celebrity which we maybe take for granted. Wells had a deeper intuition in retrospect. Not at the time.
I think it's the opposite. I think he was interested in deception and magic and fraud, and so started making this little documentary, and then the Howard Hughes hoax blew up.
Oh yeah, no. What I mean was that he didn't think anything of Irving at the time.
No, he's very dismissive of him.
And
yeah.
And in fact, like you say, it would have been a little film if it had been just on Amir, because he doesn't get very far with. You can't really. Someone like Wells would not get far with someone like Amir because he'd be too lazy to do, frankly, to do all the
legwork.
All the legwork.
Oh, yeah.
In any case, someone else did that documentary. It's on the second disc in the Criterion edition. So it's more about, kind of being around these characters and so, you know, godsend for him to have enough going on that he could then make the kind of film he would want to make.
So he's written fiction because he's too lazy to write nonfiction. That's that seems to be. There is a sense, though. So he gets to the end, you imagine there's this guy, and he's, as you said, he wants to be in the center of the story, and he's sitting there at these tables holding court, and you can see Amir de Horace desperately trying to impress Orson Welles, leaning on mantelpieces and creating these works of art and then burning them dramatically in the fireplace. And so Orson Welles feels like he's the star and he's in control and he's the one that he's the artist who gets to separate truth from fiction. You know, he's War of the Worlds and he's bloody Citizen Kane. And then it turns out that the wool's being pulled over his eyes. And rather than admitting that fact, he sort of sits back in his chair and puffs on his cigar and says, well, what is truth anyway? You know, like it feels like that's what he's done when faced with the fact that he's a sucker.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, only Wells would have the, you know, the wherewithal to you know, the sort of bulletproof ego to get away with all of that. So yeah, he is fooling us, but not in the ways that, you know, we think he is.
Yeah.
Necessarily. But
it is a very masculine film. Like, it is very...
That's the 70s.
I guess it's the 70s was a masculine time, because there's lots of men trying very hard to be men. And even, I mean, you have, you know, like, even, you know, obviously you have Clifford Irving there, who's, you know, big alpha male, and Orson Welles, and Pablo Picasso, of course, who only appears in pictures and fake conversations. But you even have, say, I mean, his driver, in inverted commas, who is, well, I'm his driver, and I, you know, come over, if he just happens to have come from Minnesota to live in Ibiza and work as his driver, in inverted commas. And it's the women in the film are treated as, but, you know, even his girlfriend, his lover, is just, as I said, she's the girl. And we have a good 10 minutes of footage of her walking around in a miniskirt where you don't even get to see her face.
Indeed.
Which, though, she claims was her idea.
Indeed. And also, I think, I mean, she was playing perhaps the long game. She ended up being his companion for the rest of his life. She's now his executor. Who knows what's... you know, none of us ever really know the details of the private mystery of relationships. But, you know, again, the whole thing is... it's like that scene in The Lady from Shanghai with the mirrors. It's all mirrors, just total mirrors. And you're not really supposed to know what's going on. Actually, you're just along for the ride.
Oh, yeah. And it is a ride. It feels, it's just, you know, I felt like I was watching an ad for a restaurant or a nightclub that was made in the 70s, the kind of trailer that would have been played in 1972. It's got that feel of the, yeah.
And indeed, famously, in his autumn years, Wells did make a lot of ads. And that's you know, for cigars and things like that. So it's not surprising that perhaps it kind of fits with the aesthetic that at least the public associated with Wells in those years. Sadly,
yeah, there is the very sad fact that if you look up Orson Welles on YouTube, that of all of the Orson Welles videos, that the most popular one is him either drunk or tired or mentally ill. On the set of a commercial, I think for frozen peas, and just not being able to get his lines right and fumbling with his words and it just falling apart. And that's the one that's the most popular of all of the things Orson Welles has done. That's the thing that people want to see again and again and again.
But it is good that, you know, he even in that sort of dissolute, falling apart time, he was able to take that and you know, work it into some kind of feature length film, and which is, you know, there's nothing else like it.
Yeah, because when it came out, it was, a lot of people raved about it, and a lot of people tried to suggest that was a case of the emperor has new clothes, and the emperor has no clothes, and that this is a ridiculous pastiche of insanity that should not be watched. But most people seem to give Orson Welles his credit as a, you know, as a filmmaker, and said no, he, you know, like, as if he'd earned good reviews for this movie, not necessarily for this one, but for everything he'd done in his career.
And also, it is a valuable record of very interesting period in hoax history where you know, almost anything was possible, you know, in old school, you know, literary hoaxing and art forgery and so on. It'd be much, much harder, much more complicated now to get away with what they got away with. These were you know, art and hoaxes of the grand style.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of celebration of that age of adventure and old school, in old school, you know, widescreen hoaxing.
Yeah. Some of the negative reviews of the film said things like, Wells stretches his material and his legend just about as thin as possible in this tedious treaty on truth and illusion. That seems an unfair review. But he definitely doesn't have a lot of material. Like I said, we told the basic premise of the film in under a minute, and the rest is very much, as you said, holding up mirrors and trying to confuse us and baffle us, and does so.
Yeah, and but you know, he carries the film somehow. I'm not quite sure how, but just through force of, well, he's you know, comes across as a kind of force of nature, and so you very much take people on their own terms, and his terms were his terms, you know, and I think also, looking at it now, it does appear to be ahead of its time, in technique certainly, and that would be partly a function, I imagine, of its influence. So again, just as Citizen Kane was such a groundbreaking film, this one too, and like I say, it was, you know, irony had been invented, but it was relatively early days of irony. And I think if we look at it with our kind of irony now, decades later, we feel we get it, whatever it is.
I think that's it, is that from a historical standpoint, we feel as if we're outside the events of the film. Whereas I imagine when it first was in cinemas, the audience would have been made up of people who were fooled by the Howard Hughes hoax and who had just discovered they'd been fooled. And because there's no real resolution to those events in the movie, and I don't think they were actually resolved for some years properly after that, it feels like it would have been at the time a living, breathing kind of current piece of work and not something.
And of course, everyone knew who Howard Hughes was.
Yeah.
As well. He was a kind of, not in character or, but it certainly in profile, he was the, you know, kind of Bill Gates or Steve Jobs of his time. He was one of those legendary business people, albeit, you know, barking by this stage. It functions in historical terms, even though it is kind of ahistorical in a way, or it's very eccentric take on the immediate past and the present.
I think we should wrap it up with my favorite negative review of the movie. It's from a more recent essay from someone who really doesn't like it, and it says Wells. It's Adam Lipp from Examiner.com, and he says Wells's assurance that you will be enthralled by his every word and oversized gesture is so arrogant, so refreshingly contemptuous that you'd give him a round of applause if you weren't sure he was doing that for himself every time he called cut. I think that's entirely true, but I'm not sure it makes it a bad movie.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.